here welcoming you to another episode of Writers Radio around this country and around the world. On today's program, you'll be meeting in a very short time Peter Pugsley, media lecturer and writer, with some short fictions, to be followed by a couple of reviews of new fictions, one for young adults called The Murderous Thumb, and the other Arnold Zabel's Sea of Many Returns. So I hope you can stay with me for the next half hour. We're kicking off the program with Peter Pugsley.
Okay, this one is called Happy. For reasons, my wife said I kept writing too many sad stories, so she said, come on, write one that's happy. So I did, and I've called it Happy. Anyway, it goes a bit like this. Glad and Ron finally did it. Saturday night, they won the lotto. 18 grand. It would have been more, except there were 28 winners, so they had to share the prize pool. Still, they was bloody happy. Ron chucked on a barbie Sunday, and everyone came. It was a pearler of a night. Free piss, snags, chops, and 9 kilos of prawns. Glad even had a few shandies. By the end of the night, round 10 o'clock, she was leading a conga line round the kitchen, through the sunroom, and down past the lemon tree. It was the biggest night down Malleuka Grove for a bloody long time. Ron was even late for the work the next day. Didn't arrive till nearly 10 past. Glad spent the morning stacking the empties for the bottle-o and burning the paper plates in the incinerator out the back. She washed all the plastic knives and forks and put them back in the pack for next time. It gives you a real good feeling to see someone like that have a bit of a win. Real battlers they are. Good luck to them, I reckon. This one's called Victor Victoria. And I've made the mistake of, I guess, trying to write sound effects at the start of it, so probably this bit may not work, but we'll see how it goes. Thuck, 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 thuck. The blades of the ride-on dealt easily with the grass of the embankment, and then it was down onto the flat. Seed heads innocently and naively submitted, and were accordingly dispensed with. On top of the mower, the young man was armed with a Walkman, and sang over and over, cheap wine and a free day grove! Cheap wine and a free day grove! The batteries had long since died, but the song lived on, going round and round, like the mower, around and around. Bloody footy ovals, boring as shit they were. Greg was a gardens man, loved the challenge, the thrill of darting in and out between the trees and the shrubs. Danger lurked there. Rose bushes, sword grasses, low-slung branches and vines, capable of ripping your head from your shoulders. But 12 years in the job, mate, and you knew your way around. Greg had the scars to prove it. There was no garden, no nature strip, or no bloody oval that could do him in. Greg lifted from the seat, exultant in the knowledge that he was invincible. He punched a fist high into the air. It was him. He was the man. He was the victor. The victor. The victor on the victor. This one's called Sydney, Poor Sydney. He'd got on the bus 10 minutes early, already dreading the journey. She dashed on just as they were about to leave. He saw her immediately, and thought, in a pathetically romantic way, that she was more beautiful than any girl had a right to be. She edged closer and closer, until he realised that she'd be sitting with him. He breathed a silent thanks to his God. They chatted a while. The Hume dragged on, but they didn't notice. They began to talk, to discuss, to analyse. She was fresh from a relationship gone wrong. He was looking for someone like her. No. No, he was looking for her. She smiled at him, and he melted into the seat. A greasy burger beneath a giant sheep. Back on the bus they kissed, and he could taste the beetroot. They left the bus one stop shy of Sydney, decided this was where they'd spend the rest of their lives. They found a motel, found a room, found a bed, found each other, even though they both knew they'd never quite reached their destination. I've spent a bit of time in China over the years as I guess, part of my, my work. I guess those sort of experiences sometimes crop up in my writing, you know, in a very sort of fictional way, but I guess they provide sort of some structure for what went on, I suppose. Anyway, this is one piece. It's called The Nanjing Banana Experiment, Journey 2. I'm wedged in the back of a Japanese minibus hurtling along the side of the Great Thai Mountain. There's ice on the windows, ropes on the tyres, and half the population of Wei Village, or is it Hu Village, I can't remember, vigorously smoking cheap cigarettes and smelling strongly of Baijiu rice wine. I love this place. The padded ex-army greatcoat barely reaches my knees, but it was a bargain at 90 kwai, and it manages to keep the top part of my body as warm as toast, and my Wei, or is it Hu Village friends, are constantly amused. Next to me is my backpacking, soon-to-be ex-girlfriend. We hit a bump and my ass leaves the wooden seat the same time as my head cracks against the luggage rack and I burp the contents of last night's dinner of pork dumplings, fish soup and mao tai. Soon-to-be girl nearly passes out from the odour. She's not amused. My other bus companions cheer at my effort. Beef jerky is passed around in celebration. This afternoon we will conquer this mountain and camp overnight in readiness for the new dawn. I have a pair of thick, wool-lined hiking boots, three pairs of long johns, a bottle of rice wine, and a disgruntled girlfriend to keep me warm. My village friends are dressed in thin slacks, bad sports coats, and leather slip-on business shoes. They are superhuman and feel no cold. I feel they are my brothers. The bus slides on a patch of ice. The girl turns even more pale than her English complexion should allow, and she bows her head low. As for the rest of us, we laugh, and the bus drives on. This is an excerpt from a novella, perhaps, or a novel, I don't know, if I get around to extending a little bit more. It's called The Lost Way. And Clary, who I refer to in here, is actually a girl. Her name's Clarissa May Smart, but everyone calls her Clary. I'm a dad. He's a boy. Brian, with a Y. Brian Angus, named after our two favourite musos. I actually wanted Bon, but the missus reckoned he'd get bashed at school. Probably right. At least we got Angus in there, eh? I was there, at the birth, when he came out and everything. I stayed up the safe end for most of it, holding Clary's hand and that, but the nurse called me down the business end when he started coming out. She reckoned I was missing the best bit. Oh, I fair dinks thought I was going to chuck, so I went back up to Clary and held her hand again. But then all of a sudden he was out, so they gave him a bit of a scrub and put him on the tit. Seemed to like that, but then who wouldn't? Clary was knocked around a bit, but only 6 stitches, so nothing to worry about. She was back home in 3 days, though, because the frickin' hospital was overflowing. They couldn't wait to get rid of her. When she got home, I was still recovering myself. Depo and I had hit the piss pretty hard that first night, and then Craig arrived the next day with the foreskin in tow. God knows why he came over, but then they're like freaking Siamese twins, those two. They're inseparable. Clary cheered up a bit when she saw them both, though, so I guess it was good for her. They only came for a lightning visit to wet the baby's head, so we hit the pubs. In honour of the little fella, we only went to pubs starting with the letter B, which was Craig's stupid idea. But after the Builder's Arms, the Baxter's Tavern, the Bridge, the Boozy Rouge, and even a couple of those Irish joints, Bridey O'Bridey's or something, we were shit-faced and we were grabbing cabs all over the city. I can't remember past the first Irish joint, though. When Clary got home, I think I was in worse nick than her. Now she's been home a couple of weeks, things are kind of settling down. Might start looking for work again. One good thing about this Centrelink mob, they don't hassle you too much. There's only about 3 people looking after the whole of the city, so they don't chase you up like the old CES used to. Clary's a bit run down, a bit narky, just from having the kid, I suppose. Not that Brian's any problem, he only wakes up 2 or 3 times a night, and I do him a fair share. Even changed a few nappies. The wet ones, I don't do the shitty ones. A bloke has to draw the line somewhere. Besides, most of the time the little fella's got the squirts, and it stinks so bad I can't even be in the same room. Clara usually takes him out to the laundry when he's like that, hoses him down. Gross little bloke, though. Like I said, Clara's a bit sensitive at the moment. I made the mistake of telling her I reckon she had a touch of that prenatal depression, and I kind of know a bit about it, because they had a thing on Current Affair, like a big special on it. I don't know if it was Ray or Mike, but it was real in-depth. Anyway, she went full-on ballistic. I told her to keep it down or she'd wake Brian. But that just made her shout even louder. Jeez. Just goes to show, eh? Proves my point. Prenatal for sure. This is a bit later in the story, and the narrator's had a bit of a run of bad luck. Clary's run off on him, and his dad's just died. So here we find him back at his mum's. Ended up going to mum's for dinner the next few nights. By the third night, I'm sitting there at the table, and I'd just finished my third helping of banana and lamb curry. Mate, those sultanas are a bit crook, but she's always made it like that. When I noticed the way mum was shuffling around, like an old person. There was this old lady in mum's kitchen, and it was me mum. She was even having trouble opening the carton of custard for our stewed rhubarb, mumbling something about how she couldn't see where you're supposed to open the blessed thing. It was at that moment that I realised what made people old. It wasn't time. It was grief. I mean, think about it, eh? Each time something happens, someone dying or a breakup, then that thing, that event, gets gouged out on your face, on your body. The pain of it. The burden. I know, because I can start seeing it in my own face. Each day a bit more the worse for wear. And mum, well, she's been through the big one. The bloke she's loved, honoured and obeyed for more than 30 frickin' years, just up and gone. Shit. How are you supposed to deal with that? How can you reconciliate that? And it's just as bad with me and Clary. I mean, here we are married for 10 bloody minutes and she's off tooling around with some other turd. Some lowlife. Cutting somebody else's grass. It's all the same, this grief thing. So now it's just my little old mum and little old me. Pathetic piece of shit that I am. Sitting here in an awkward silence. At the very table that used to have a whole family at it. Mum, Dad, and two kids. Just laughing and fighting and hanging shit like regular families do. Now Dad's gone and Josie's off with Australia's Most Wanted. So it's just Mum and me, sitting here. All I can hear is the ticking of the clock up on the wall. Tick, frickin' tock.
Okay, let's have a little bit of a chat about that. That's really interesting stuff, Peter, and I'm thinking that the real achievement there is to get the voice and the tone right, because you don't want to patronise your characters, and you don't, I don't think, although we laugh at them in a kindly sort of a way, but I don't think you're diminishing them at all.
Yeah, well, thanks. I guess it's sort of one thing I try to capture in my writing is sort of the use of the vernacular, and I think it's something that's kind of missing. And in fact, a lot of I like reading things like William Faulkner, which, you know, very much steeped in that American tradition of the vernacular, which they do so well in American writing. And often I think it's kind of perhaps missing a little bit in Australian writing. And I try to bring that back in if I can, you know.
That's right, or else it's done very self-consciously, you know, with a nod back to C.J. Dennis or something.
Yeah.
Except that you get it sometimes in good Australian comedy, don't you, where there's no diminishment of or disrespect implied, but the comedy is in the fact that it's caught so precisely.
Yes, absolutely.
So some of your characters mispronounce things, and you know, but you can see where they're coming from, and you can understand from the treatment you give them why they mightn't know how to pronounce a certain word, or you know, it's just obviously not necessarily their fault or any slight intended to them.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know how much of it is kind of, I don't know, observational from my own growing up or travelling around or what. But yeah, I think it's something that's kind of, I don't know, nice to capture. And
it is. And I'm finding the later stuff quite poignant. 'Cause he's a bloke. He's your average sort of a bloke, but he's not scared to try and think things through. He doesn't run away from grappling with the issues.
Yeah.
And a little bit of intellectual struggle with them.
Mm.
And he's doing his best.
Yeah. Although I don't know about the not running away from things later on in the story. He has a bit more trouble sort of coping with these things. But yeah. I don't know. Is that the crisis of the Australian male, perhaps, in trying to face up to what's expected of you, perhaps? I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I like where it seems to be going.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. And the other pieces that are self-contained and little kind of miniatures,
yeah.
Do they come easily? Is that the sort of thing you just sit down and toss one off
on the
bus?
Yeah. Sometimes I'll kind of sit in my head for a little while before I'll actually, you know, sit down and usually I'll write it in longhand and then go and kind of edit as I type it up, I suppose.
Mm.
But yeah, they sort of come, you know, usually at the most inopportune moments where I'm sitting listening to someone else talk or I'm teaching or something like that. But then it'll kind of stick there, and then when I get a chance, I'll sit down and write it.
And so you teach in the media department. You know, how do you categorise those little pieces? They're not quite short stories, I suppose. They're ultra short fictions or something.
Yeah, I guess they are. I don't like to call them poems or poetry. I don't.
Could almost be, you know, little prose poems.
Yeah. But then I don't see myself as a poet. I, you know, not that I've got anything against that term, but I, you know, I see other people, I think they're poets, you know. I don't know. I'm a short story writer, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess it's that thing of just trying to capture vignettes, is that the word?
Mm.
of life, of different people. And I've tried writing things with sort of, you know, very middle-class, well-spoken characters, but I struggle a bit with that, and I find, I don't know, it's hard to find the humour there, I guess. You know, a lot of it, I guess, is written as well for spoken word stuff, which I tend to do. I've sent very little off to publishers, so most of my stuff has been spoken word. So, no, I like that idea of the, you know, the word coming to life, if you like, as your program does very well, I must say.
You heard there Adelaide University media lecturer and writer Peter Pugsley. I'm Kath Keneally, and time to look at a recent achievement in writing for young people.
It's no easy task writing a good crime novel featuring a youthful sleuth. Too young to drink, to drive, to wander the mean streets, or to have a wasted past. They also have parents lurking in the background, ever ready to assert their authority about meals and bedtimes. Full credit then to Beth Montgomery for overcoming these obstacles and writing a gripping mystery. In Murderous Thumb, published by Text at 1995, 14-year-old Adam Statkus and his mother have relocated from the city to the country in yet another effort to escape an abusive husband and father who is in constant pursuit of them despite court orders. They are living on a dairy farm in the small rural community of Falcon Ridge, where Rosemary Statkus, jittery and terrified, is in no state to assert any authority over her son beyond instilling in him the necessity of keeping a low profile. That becomes harder to maintain when Adam, in his very first week, and in the company of one of the local lads who has offered to show him how a farm works, finds the decomposed body, well, skeleton really, of a teenage girl, which is buried in a silage pit. End of chapter one. We're off to a great start. It is soon confirmed that the remains are those of the dairy farmer's teenage daughter, who, with a girlfriend, disappeared 6 years earlier. Adam is not much impressed by the local policeman's rather casual attitude to the discovery. His Lithuanian grandfather was a detective inspector back in the 1930s, and Adam seems to have inherited the Sherlock gene. In any case, when he stumbles upon a curious little note hidden in a piece of furniture in the rented house, he is convinced it holds the key to the murder. "Find me," the note says, "a diary. Look for the 89th key." It is signed with the initials MT. Well, Adam and the plot take off. The clue does indeed lead Adam to the diary, but only to part of it. The writer, the mysterious M.T., has divided the diary into parts, and each is hidden in a different location, and finding them is crucial because Adam is convinced they will reveal the truth behind the murdered body found in the silage pit. But it is not so easy. Each clue is cryptically encoded. Luckily, Adam, thanks to his mother, a cryptic crossword fan, is adept at solving each one. And there are others who would also like to get their hands on the diary. Now, you might well wonder why a person so intent on exposing a murder would make it so damn difficult. Why split a document into five parts? Why leave clues so cryptically clever they might never be deciphered? The fact is that the diary is a MacGuffin, a device to send Adam charging off in pursuit of the truth. He begins to look more closely at his new community, and in particular the dairy farm of the murdered girl. He gets a casual job as a milker, and is thus well placed to carry out his surreptitious investigation. Is her father, grumpy and unsociable, hiding something? What about the weird mother, a religious nut or simply unbalanced with grief? The girl's brother is a bit simple, he might be the murderer. Or Ludi, the loud-mouthed but seemingly affable farmhand, who, with his friend Mungrel, were at a party with the murdered girl and her friend when they were last seen. As the story progresses, Adam learns more and more of the circumstances leading up to the girl's disappearance. Following the last clue, Adam must use an aerial photo of the farm, which he notices is in the shape of a human hand. The various fences and markings lead him to a particular landmark right in the palm of the hand, the so-called murderer's thumb, and the climactic exposure of the murderer. Does this all sound too clever for words? Can you imagine any 14-year-old boy solving such a complicated case? Well, as Adam himself muses at one point, it was like being on the set of CSI or Midsummer Murders, shows he never missed on TV. And as in those shows, a little suspension of disbelief is called for. And the reward is a cracking murder mystery that should appeal to a wide range of readers from young teens upwards. Adam is a tough, credible and appealing protagonist, and the evocation of a close-knit farming community and the build-up of tension are terrific. Murderer's Thumb is a real page-turner.
Murderer's Thumb by Beth Montgomery, for young adults, for whom Ruth Starkey, our reviewer, also writes. And now Gillian Dooley is going to introduce us to Arnold Zabel's latest novel.
Arnold Zabel is an essayist and novelist with several books to his name, and his latest novel is Sea of Many Returns, a family saga based on the Greek island of Ithaca, Odysseus's island in the Ionian Sea. Xanthe is Australian-born, but both her grandfathers, Mentor and Stratus, were Ithacans who came to Australia to find their fortunes. Stratus left a wife and two young sons back in Ithaca and returned after many years to find the younger son, Manoli, an alienated teenager, resentful at his father's long absence. Eventually, Manoli sails away from Ithaca to Australia, as his father had before him, to meet and marry Mentor's daughter, Sophia, in Melbourne. Years after Manoli's death, his daughter Xanthe visits Ithaca for the first time and meets her uncle Andreas, Manoli's brother. Later she returns again with a manuscript from her maternal grandfather, Mentor, relating his first days in Australia in 1916 as a member of a foreign community in xenophobic Kalgoorlie, and his travels across the country to find a home in Melbourne where he puts down roots and lives out his life. She translates Mentor's manuscript, interspersing it with her own story and that of her father, Manoli. Sea of Many Returns is an ambitious work, laden with myth, redolent with traces of ancient history and legend. The opening words are, "Beware, dear reader, the story you are about to be told is a fairy tale, a romance." The fable-like atmosphere is underlined by the perpetual present tense of the narrative and the stereotyped characters, the repetition of certain phrases like incantations, and the weight of symbolism. There is little of the usual ebb and flow of narrative. Events don't happen in the simple present, they are recurrent. Every night he would go fishing, every year a young man drowned, so that even dramatic events like the Kalgoorlie riots seem automatic and inevitable, and there is no feeling that events might go otherwise, which means, of course, that there is no suspense. This works best during the part of the book when Xanthe is recounting her father's increasingly erratic last years, tormenting his wife and daughter when not escaping to the sea in his home-built boats, until he succumbs to a stroke. Elsewhere, the rhythms of the narrative succeed only in becalming the reader. It took me an unusually long time to read this novel because after a few pages I would invariably nod off. Zabel transmits something of the tragedy and romance of Ithaca, but with its stilted dialogue and Homeric echoes, and without a shred of humour even when the opportunity stands up and begs for it, Sea of Many Returns is a lugubrious work of unrelieved solemnity.
Gillian Dooley with that rundown of The Sea of Many Returns, and I'll be talking to Arnold Zabel about the writing process and that novel and how he intended it to come across in a later edition of Writers Radio. Meanwhile, that's all there's time for today. I hope you've enjoyed the program. I'm Kath Keneally, and I'll be seeing you again, I hope, same time next week. The program is supported by the Commonwealth Government and the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you're the author of as yet unpublished prose or poetry that you think would sound good on this program, all you have to do is send it to me for consideration to Radio Adelaide, 228 North Terrace, Adelaide 5000, or to my email address, catherine.keneally@adelaide.edu.au. That's catherine.keneally@adelaide.edu.au.
That I got.